Well, good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Stephen McWhorter, and I am attorney number 41148. I represent Ms. Heidi Rogers, the appellant and the plaintiff below in this case. The briefs in this case were somewhat complicated, so I would like to simplify what I see as the main issue and essentially the only real issue in this case. And that is, did the district court err when it found as a matter of law that no reasonable jury could find that Ms. Rogers didn't know and should not have known that the appellees were negligent simply upon hearing her ex-husband state that he could do what he wanted with his home and may violate the settlement agreement? I submit to you that Scott Rogers' statement was completely unrelated to whether Ms. Smolin was negligent, and I ask you to reverse the district court's order of summary judgment and remand this case for trial. Parties to a divorce make statements like Scott Rogers all the time. Things go wrong in litigation. That does not mean that a lawyer was negligent or that a client was put on notice of negligence. If it did, every case that was resolved via trial or summary judgment would result in a malpractice action. There needs to be something more. Here, the court relied on the fact that the marital home was not sold and that Scott Rogers claimed that he could do what he wanted with his house. But neither of these facts have anything to do with whether or not Ms. Smolin was negligent. This is particularly true when Mr. Rogers had previously violated the settlement agreement and been brought back into line by Ms. Smolin. Ms. Rogers had no reason to doubt that she could do the same thing again. Ms. Rogers hired an attorney, Ms. Smolin, to represent her in her divorce. She relied on Ms. Smolin to point out the potential pitfalls and to advise her properly. Ms. Rogers is not an attorney. In the state of Colorado, before a professional negligence suit can proceed against an attorney, another attorney has to review that case and certify that it does not lack substantial merit. A certificate of review was filed in this case. The reason for the requirement is that the issues are difficult to spot. A client hires an attorney to spot the issues for them, and the client has no foundation to know when an attorney has missed an issue. Attorneys often have a hard time finding each other's errors, and it's not reasonable to expect an untrained non-attorney to find those issues on her own.
Well, Mr. McWhorter, let me ask you about this. It looks like you're speaking to the part of cause, not so much injury, but whether it's a discovery of the cause of the injury.
Yes, Your Honor, and I submit that we had Ms. Rogers was not on notice of either the injury or the cause of the injury.
Okay.
Either damages or causation.
Okay, so the causation, what you're speaking to is who was the cause, and then if we speak to injury, what is the injury that you're speaking of?
Well, that's actually a good question, Your Honor. She was not injured unless the house would have been sold otherwise, and this house was on the market for well over $500,000 in the middle of the housing crisis. There is no real evidence in the record that indicates that the house would have sold even if Mr. Rogers had been marketing it actively. I think that Ms. Smolin has a burden to show that the house would have been sold before she's entitled to summary judgment. Until the house would have been sold, Ms. Rogers didn't have any damages at all. Alternatively, as I mentioned in the brief, damages could be ascertained when she took on more attorney fees, which didn't happen until September of 2010.
Okay. Excuse me, counsel, you're saying something that strikes me as unusual, that you're saying that the defendant has to prove that the plaintiff incurred damages?
No, she has to prove that there's no issue of genuine fact. No genuine issue of material fact as to whether damages were incurred. And she has shown no evidence to counter. She has not shown that Ms. Rogers even had proof of damages at that point.
Is it your position that the plaintiff had no damages?
It's my position that the plaintiff had no way of knowing if she had damages. There would need to be some sort of expert testimony showing that the home would have been sold had it been placed on the market and marketed actively. She did have damages, definitely, once she incurred attorney fees when she visited Dale Johnson, who told her that the settlement agreement was not enforceable.
So if your case went to trial, the recovery of by your plaintiff of damages would have been solely attorney fees?
No, Your Honor. I'm just saying that she did not know in 2008 or 2009, 2010 that the house would have sold at that point. So she did not have knowledge of the damages at that point. But it doesn't really matter because she certainly had no evidence to, or no reason to think that her attorney had failed her. Her ex-husband had breached the agreement in the past. He had been brought back into line by Ms. Smallin, and Ms. Rogers had no reason to believe that the same thing wouldn't happen again if Ms. Smallin had been brought in to enforce the settlement. So what I'm saying is that there's an issue of material fact as to what damages she had and when she knew about them. I'm not saying that she didn't have damages. I'm saying that we need a trial to determine what those damages were and when they were incurred.
You may proceed, counsel.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Rogers gave Scott time to sell the house, and he told her at various times that he was trying to sell that house. She felt that the best way to push him to get the house sold as fast as possible was to negotiate with him and not necessarily to bring legal action. Once again, she had no reason to believe that Ms. Smallin's agreement was unenforceable. So finally, in July of 2010, she did contact Ms. Smallin. She asked her to enforce that agreement, or she intended to ask her to enforce the agreement. She sent her 4 emails, and she left her voicemails, but Ms. Smallin refused to return any of those emails or those phone calls, despite the fact that she was still Ms. Rogers' attorney of record. After several months of being ignored...
By making those phone calls, is it your position that she's exercising reasonable diligence?
I believe that, yes, she was exercising more than reasonable diligence. She decided that she had given her ex-husband sufficient time to sell the home and that it was time to enforce that settlement. She still did not have any reason to believe that the agreement was not enforceable. Eventually, after waiting for several months to hear from Ms. Smallin and still not having her phone calls returned, she then had to contact Dale Johnson, who told her at that time that the agreement was unenforceable and that another part of the agreement took jurisdiction away from the divorce court and therefore nothing could be done about it against Mr. Rogers, and that her only recourse was a legal malpractice.
So sorry to interrupt again. So it's your position that the meeting with Mr. Johnson is when the statute began to accrue and no time before that?
That is my position, Your Honor. Arguably, it could be when Ms. Smallin refused to answer the phone or return an email, but I believe that it definitely came about when she incurred attorney fees. Now, Ms. Rogers is entitled to all favorable inferences permitted by the facts in this case. Here, the district court made only one inference, that Mr. Rogers' statement that he could do what he wanted with his house put her on notice of Ms. Smallin's negligence. That inference is not permissible because only Ms. Rogers here was entitled to any inference by the court. A reasonable jury could find that Ms. Rogers reasonably believed that the agreement was enforceable and that Ms. Smallin could utilize the court system again just as she had in the past. As her expert, Mr. Richard Brickmont, noted in his report, parties often act in bad faith in the context of a divorce. His statement that he didn't intend to abide by the agreement had no bearing on her negligence, and her only experience in this area of law was when she had seen Ms. Smallin enforce the agreement in the past. I also submit that the court erred when it applied a may have been caused standard. It granted summary judgment because it found that Ms. Rogers had been put on notice that Smallin's negligence may have caused her damages. CRS 1380-108 states that a cause of action accrues when both the injury and its cause were known or should have been discovered. Even if his statements had any bearing on her negligence, a finding that her damages may have been caused by Ms. Smallin does not meet that standard. Furthermore, Ms. Rogers was only damaged if there were evidence that the house could have been sold. And as I said, whether the house on the market for over $500,000 would have sold is unclear at that time. Allen v. Martin and Morrison v. Goff were the two cases relied on by the district court, and they both hold that the cause of action accrues when the injury and its cause were known or should have been known by reasonable diligence. Again, this may have been cause standard does not meet that requirement. I submit that Ms. Rogers has demonstrated the existence of a genuine issue of material fact, and this case should proceed to trial. Even without that, however, I think you should reverse the district court's order because the equitable tolling doctrine should have told statute of limitations. The record contains good evidence that Ms. Smallin refused to return phone calls, refused to return emails. As a result, Ms. Rogers did not know that the settlement agreement was unenforceable and that, as Smallin argues, the statute still kept running. If she's able to escape responsibility for her mistakes by simply refusing to communicate with clients, that will encourage other attorneys who make mistakes to do the same. As Ms. Smallin noted in her affidavit, she was concerned about Ms. Rogers' ability to pay her, but that does not give her the right to abandon her client and to not tell her about the unenforceability of the agreement. Mr. Brickmont noted in his report that Ms. Smallin sent a letter to Scott Rogers' husband, or to Scott Rogers' attorney on July 22, 2010, about this issue, about the home sale clause. A reasonable jury could find that that is when she determined that the clause was unenforceable, but she still refused to contact Ms. Rogers. Ms. Smallin should not be able to avoid responsibility by committing further wrongful acts against her client. I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right. You have 2 minutes and 20 seconds remaining. It's at the lip of the podium. You found it. Okay.
They should have them in every courtroom. Good afternoon. My name is Linda Sue Smolin. My registration number is 130-83. I would start out by saying that the plaintiff in this case has never alleged any facts in opposition of the summary judgment, only conclusions. She has been given every opportunity by the trial court to put that forth. She has not done it. The initial raising of the statute of limitations was on May 21st, 2012, in the answer. At that time, the court could have treated it as a motion for summary judgment, but instead denied it and set it for trial. Once discovery was underway, deposition was taken, deposition became part of the record, it was clear that Ms. Rogers was on notice what her husband was doing or ex-husband was doing or not doing. The trial court specifically pointed out in its ruling that Ms. Rogers ignored the analysis of the statute of limitations and the discovery rule and only what she allegedly knew. In thinking about this case, and reviewing the pleadings before I came here, and it's probably 8 inches thick. And I looked at pleading after pleading after response and pleading, and the sense I got was, let's throw mud at the wall and see how much sticks. Let's see if anything sticks. And the judge gave him another chance, and they still didn't. And that's what Judge McDonald, he didn't just, it was not a knee-jerk reaction from him to simply say denied. He denied my initial motion, said there might be, gave Ms. Rogers an opportunity to put forth facts in opposition. She never did. What's glaring in this, the record, what's lacking is anything from Mr. Rogers. The plaintiff had subpoena power. They could bring somebody in for a deposition, but it's not there. She simply wants to say, well, this is what I think.
Well, Ms. Nolan, let me ask you about the court's ruling on summary judgment. So the court was stating that by virtue of husband saying I can do whatever I want, that the inference in what she should have known is she should have referenced the separation agreement to see if that was accurate, and then in seeing if the separation agreement did not require husband to sell the home, then she should have known that the cause was attorney negligence. So I'd like you to address that piece.
Simply that Judge McDonald indicated that by his statement alone? Is that your question?
Mm-hmm.
That is what Judge McDonald pointed to. I think the record has many other instances in there that Ms. Rogers went to the home numerous times, knew that there was a for sale sign, knew that it had been taken down. It was not one instance, and that is part of the deposition that's in the record, that there were numerous times that she knew. She went up to the house to see their dog on a very regular basis and questioned him. And so I think Judge McDonald culled out that one statement that has arisen from the deposition that he could do anything he wanted. I think it should be noted that she still has a very viable remedy here, and that is the district court. Judge Montgomery, who was the initial trial court judge in the dissolution action, there is a very, very specific order that the house be sold. There is a remedy. You go back to court. You ask to enforce that order. That's what you do. And so she failed to ever do anything. I think Judge McDonald also pointed out she knew she had contempt remedies. She's done it twice before in the case. So I think Judge McDonald taking that one statement, I think that encompassed the deposition, how much came out at that point in time in the deposition that she knew over and over again, the sign was up, the sign was down, I can do whatever I want to, I'm not selling it, I built this house, I'm not going anywhere.
All right, well, can you address for me then, because I think that the argument Mr. McWhorter was making was that the court was not making a favorable inference in the favor of Ms. Rogers by saying that by that information she should have known that her attorney was negligent.
I'm not sure I'm understanding it.
All right. So in summary judgment,
absolutely,
favorable inferences must be made in favor of the non-moving party.
Correct.
And what his argument is the court did not do that.
And I think what happened here is initially the court said, in May of 2012, there could still be an issue here. I need more information. Discovery is going to happen. And then it proceeded. And so the court did give her those inferences. I think the court went back and used that one statement, and maybe the court shouldn't have used that one statement in his ruling, but I think the court did, and everything else said, these are just conclusions you're saying, that maybe this might happen. And I think the burden shifts once it's raised, once the statute of limitation is raised, the burden absolutely shifts for a factual statement by the plaintiff at that point in time. And so what Judge McDonald said, you're not giving me any factual statements except that what your ex-husband said, and I'm going to take that and use that. And so that wasn't enough, and I think he just went back to say, that's the best you can do, but I'm going to use that, and say that there is absolutely some evidence here, and that there is no factual evidence by Ms. Rogers to dispute the summary judgment. And so I think that's what Judge McDonald was looking at.
Excuse me, counsel, can you please respond to your learned opponent's comment that to grant summary judgment in this situation allows an attorney to take advantage of a situation by not responding to telephone calls and contacts by a client?
Absolutely. And I'm going to apologize because I'm not 100% certain that it's in the record or not, but I believe it is. And so I just want to say that because I can't point to it, that that is absolutely erroneous that she contacted my office four different times. I did receive a letter from her, and that's when I contacted her and opposing counsel. She may have sent four emails, and she sent me a copy of them, and they were going to some unknown email address.
Okay. Well, regardless of the number of contacts,
sure.
What I want you to respond to is the legal point that was raised, that allowing summary judgment under those circumstances is improper because it allows an attorney to just avoid the client.
I think it's a good point that if an attorney, you know, there has to be some line drawn that an attorney just can't stonewall somebody. But if in fact an attorney did that, then I think the client, like she did here, goes to another attorney. Whether Mr. Johnson's advice to her was correct, that it would be difficult, is what his affidavit said, to unring this bell. I think the clear language of Judge Montgomery's order, it's not difficult at all. The house shall be sold is not vague. And so I don't think that an attorney can obviate their duty by simply not responding to something. But when they do, and she chooses to do nothing for a very long period of time, which is what Judge McDonald found in this case, that there was contact and then nothing for about 18 months. So I don't think that, I think an attorney doesn't escape their duty and can't take advantage of summary judgment because of that position. Does that answer your question?
You can proceed.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Mullen, could I need some clarification and then maybe a follow-up to Judge Lichtenstein's question. If we're looking at a dispute about a material fact, let's assume for the sake of argument that the settlement agreement did not have an enforcement mechanism and should have, that there was some kind of a duty on your part. What material facts are undisputed on that regard? Because I'm having a hard time understanding the nexus, the link between not knowing a house will ever be sold or maybe it won't be sold, there's other enforcement mechanisms, and the duty question. You see what I'm saying?
Go through it a little bit more.
I'm not understanding. Well, I think you said earlier that there's other enforcement mechanisms that she had. I don't see what relevance that has to the duty question, to an attorney malpractice question, a negligence question.
And the negligence being that the separation agreement doesn't have a fallback clause?
Right.
Okay. Fair enough. Because...
Isn't that what the judge determined? I'm having a hard time understanding how one leads to another.
How not having a safety net in the separation agreement is I didn't have a duty? Is that your question? So in a dissolution action, it is the only section of our law that is pretty much based in equity. You can always petition the court. And while this didn't have a fallback per se, there are remedies in a dissolution action to go back to court in equity to force what the intent was there. And there was the separation agreement, but there was also the very first order in the initial status conference from Judge Montgomery to sell the house. That doesn't dissolve that order at any time because there is a separation agreement. It was clear there. Whether Mr. Rogers didn't want to sell this home, I think that
well, all right, let me rephrase it a different way. When does the statute of limitation accrue on these facts, in your position?
I think for Ms. Rogers that when she was told by Mr. Rogers, I have no intention of selling this house, I'm not moving anywhere, I think she knew at that point in time.
Knew what?
Knew that there was an issue, and let me, as she had done twice before, very specifically, asked to avail the court of contempt procedures to bring him in, and he was found in contempt, and he was assessed attorney's fees. And so I think that then she knew each time. Similar, the analogy would be when he didn't pay her maintenance. She knew when she didn't get maintenance that there was something wrong here. So I think it's not...
Okay, then what is Mr. Johnson's position?
Mr. Johnson, who wrote the letter? Mr. Johnson's position is that it would be difficult to go back to court. That's what he said. And it would cost her a lot of money. That's what he said. Not impossible. That was not it at all. And my sense is that either he didn't want to do it, he was going to charge her a lot of money, whatever, but... It doesn't take that much to interpret the dissolution statute in equity. The preface to the dissolution statute is to keep things fair and to work out a property settlement, if there's children, of course. But in this case, Mr. Johnson simply said it would be difficult to do. I disagree with that. I think that because Judge Montgomery had a specific court order. And while those magic words were not used in the separation agreement, absolutely, it would be sold. It didn't have a date to be sold by. It didn't say it
which would be the enforcement mechanism.
Absolutely. That would be a very, very bright line enforcement mechanism.
So it's your position that at some point where he said, I don't intend to sell the house, that she should have known there was a duty, an enforcement mechanism in the agreement that was not there?
Absolutely.
How?
How would she know?
Yeah.
Just like if she didn't get her maintenance check, which that happened. Bring him into court and just say, judge, tell him to sell the house. And the judge can fashion something within the separation agreement outside of that and say, it's very clear this is what was supposed to happen. And that needs to happen. And the history of this case, the law of this case is the agreement from the parties that the house shall be sold. And it goes back to the beginning of the case. That's the law of the case. And so the next judge who takes it up says, yes, that's correct. This house needs to be sold. Mr. Rogers, I'll give you X amount of time, however you want to do it. But that's what happens. You bring them back into court.
All right. Ms. Smolin, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Ms. Smolin argued that there were no facts, or that Ms. Rogers had put forth no facts to preclude summary judgment. She did put forth facts. She put forth facts that she did not know about Ms. Smolin's negligence. She put forth the fact that a layperson may not know that the clause was unenforceable, and that a reasonable jury could find that a non-attorney, to a non-practitioner, it looked like she had an enforceable right to force the sale of that home. She also ignored the fact that the defendant has to prove an affirmative defense. That burden is on her, and summary judgment was granted based on her affirmative defense of the statute of limitations, and she has not reached her burden of proof on that issue. I also want to say that not all bad developments trigger an inquiry into professional negligence. There needs to be something more than my ex-husband said that he is not going to sell the home, or actually he didn't say he wasn't going to, he said that he could do what he wanted with his house. Even if Ms. Rogers could seek relief in equity, as she argued, she still has to incur attorney fees that could have been avoided, and as two attorneys have found, she would likely lose that argument in equity because the agreement was very clear that the district court had no further jurisdiction. She can raise the issue, but the court is likely to rule against her because it had no jurisdiction. The parties agreed that this is what the agreement is with regards to spousal maintenance, and I'm sorry, but you should have read the document more clearly, or your attorney should have read the document more clearly. I submit to you that Ms. Rogers has raised genuine issues of material fact. I ask that you reverse Judge McDonald's order and remand this case back to trial. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.